The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
What are the origins of your story ideas?
Sometimes the origin is as simple as me deciding I need to write a story today, and I just pluck a sentence out of midair and start there. Other times I'll have an idea that derives from family or experience or something like that. So they come from everywhere and nowhere. I wish I had a better answer for that, because then maybe I could access those ideas a little more readily than I do.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a literary program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. Matt Pavlich is my guest this time. We're talking about his collection of stories titled Survivors Said. So most of the collections, the story collections I've read, a title of one of the stories will become the title of the book. But there's no story titled Survivors Said in this book. So where does the title come from?
Well, none of the stories in this book have gained enough notoriety to probably to function as a title story for a collection. And the collection is kind of diverse enough that the title of any given story might not suffice to indicate what the collection as a whole is about. And so Survivors Said was my attempt to encapsulate what I think maybe the collection is about. The characters seem to be connected in only one sense, in that all of them managed to get through and be able to tell the tale or have their tale told.
Even the dead guy. Well, the voices and the narrators in these stories are quite different from one another, as you said. They range from teenage girls to middle-aged men to a pre-human creature of some kind that's in the first story 10,000 years ago. How do you identify and capture all of these different voices?
It seems to be a process that takes place in the writing. You solve it sentence by sentence and try to adhere to some standard in your head that builds sentence upon sentence upon sentence. And each of those sentences should be consistent with the sentence before it, not only logically, but in terms of voice. And so I just try to build them a little bit at a time. Also, it's a process of stepping inside the character and trying inhabiting them long enough to not only see the world the way they see it, but begin to speak the way they speak.
So you've got a person inside of your head speaking in a way that you don't normally speak.
Right.
In the story, Himself Adrift, your narrator thinks, I continued, I was, I am. One survives and survives, and every survival exacts its price. My God, I am hard to extinguish. I love that. So tell us who this is and why he's hard to extinguish.
That is the putative voice of Thomas Francis Marr. And that story takes up where he disappeared off a flatboat or a sternwheeler in Fort Benton, never to be found. Great opening for a fiction writer. And in trying to come to terms with who this guy was, I noticed he seemed to dabble in a lot of different things and create a lot of death around him, particularly. He was a Civil War general and led a brigade of Irishmen that was just decimated over and over again in some of the worst conflicts of the war. But he survived. He survived a rebellion that he probably in his own mind should not have survived, and any number of things. And yet here he still is, and his moral ammunition all spent, but he's still here.
And he was the acting territorial governor of Montana in the mid-1800s, is that right?
It would have been 1867 was when he died, and he'd only been out of office a brief time at that point. He was a political appointee in exchange for raising those brigades that he sacrificed to the great cause. He was given a secretaryship, I believe, originally in Montana Territory.
But didn't he start out in Ireland getting arrested and shipped off to a penal colony in Australia?
Yeah, Tasmania. and he was paroled there, as the story mentions, and escaped. And then he sailed around the Horn to California, went to New York. He was a newspaper editor, a trial lawyer. Then the war broke out, and he was a general. Originally, that story was intended to be a novel, and that got circumvented, A, by my agent saying, no, historical stuff doesn't fly anymore. And also in my research, I'd like to acknowledge Paul Wiley, who did a magnificent biography, and that was the bulk of my research. And in doing that, I kind of got the sense of the man that here was a man who led a very fascinating life, but maybe wasn't a real fascinating guy. So I thought I'd pick up with him where he'd fallen off the end of the earth, and apparently he was maybe even hallucinating when all that happened in the throes of some kind of alcoholic problem, and go from there and fill in the blanks. And maybe he'd become more interesting to me at that point as a personality. I'm not diminishing the depth of his thinking. He was brilliant. I don't think a man could be an orator of that persuasiveness without having some depth. It's just that he seemed to be motivated by a single thought, and that was expelling the English from Ireland. And it became, as he got farther and farther from Ireland, it became increasingly quixotic, I think, and weird.
Yeah, because expelling the English from Ireland really has not a lot to do with being a Civil War general.
In his mind, it did. Yeah. He had hoped to these Irish brigades that he raised to harden them, to make them battle-hardened troops, and take them back to Ireland and finish what he'd started.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, the first story is unusual. Can you tell us about that narrator? Where did a guy living 12,000 years ago come from?
Again, sentence by sentence, I determined the general parameters of the story and then build it brick by brick. The limitations were kind of interesting to me because here was a pre-verbal kind of guy, or had been in the iteration I was talking about. And I kind of wanted to talk about a culture that was pre-verbal and maybe superior to our wordier culture.
And yet it was quite a feat just to get to sexual maturity and still be alive and intact.
Right. And a lot of that species was just predicated on my understanding of other sort of semi-hominid species and how they progress through the world. I was interested in the idea of a sentient group of beings who had existed in the world and then didn't. It was just gone, and their world was gone, and trying to express what that might be like.
But going back to the idea that sparked the story, do you remember what that was?
Yeah, again, this is something I had thought of as a novel. this consciousness, I at one point was thinking of dragging him through the ages to contemporary life and inhabiting various creatures, probably most of them human beings, at various stages, but retaining that memory of all the past lives. It got awfully unwieldy, so I abandoned it, but I managed to squeeze 5 or 6 pages out of the concept anyway. Kind of a consciousness adrift and lighting into different creatures. but not one who continued to exist in the same body.
Well, let's hear from one of your teenage girls. I liked the stories that had teenage girls in them. I liked their voices particularly. Did you sit around and listen to some teenage girls to get
this? I had a teenage girl in my own household, and she and her friends were particularly with this story. All I had to do was think back, and I kind of, as a lot of writers will do when they choose to write from the point of a younger person, they choose a precocious younger person, because otherwise you're saddled with a degree of articulateness that doesn't allow you much room. So, and she sufficed in that way, too.
All right. This one's called Summer Family.
Thanks. My Uncle Carl somehow finds out I'm a violin player, so he asked my mom to send me out to spend some time on his farm. Like that makes any sense. I'm supposed to finally meet my mom's side of the family, the Mastersons, and it doesn't matter that there's a boy interested in me that summer, and they don't care if I've got a nice job at the mall where all I have to do is smell pretty. No, my parents just drag me down to the bus station, and it's, have a great time, honey, and over the mountains I go. But I did see a bear up around the top of the pass, this insanely cute little cub with fur that shudders when it runs, which is all right, but also there's a baby screaming in back for most of the way, and I know about how that baby must feel, but that doesn't mean I've got any sympathy for it. You have to wonder why certain people, including me, don't just stay home. Uncle Carl's the only one waiting, and I'm the only one getting off in Cutbank. They leave the bus running, so we're standing there in those black fumes, and Uncle Carl looks like he does in the pictures they send with their Christmas cards, but he's taller than I expected. In his boots and hat and everything, he's like a tree. We shake. My hand totally disappears. I get my suitcase out from under the bus, and he's carrying it for me, and he says he's disappointed that I didn't bring my instrument. Says he plays a little fiddle himself, but that's all right. He's glad to see me anyway, and he's got one I can use if I want, if I feel like I need to practice sometimes. And he's about to cry, which is going overboard, I think, but he tells me I took him by surprise. I caught him off guard. Says I'm the spitting image of his mother. Edna, wasn't it? This would be the grandmother my mom never mentions, the real dead one. She'd be my mother's mother. We called her Dutch. I tell him that if I ever met her, I was too little to remember. My, says Uncle Carl, what a resemblance. Of course, I never knew her when she was your age, and I don't necessarily believe she was ever as young as you are now, but it's wild how much... You sound like her, too. Same voice. Only way you'd ever win an argument with your grandma was to kill her, and nobody ever did that, so she won them all. She was sort of famous for it. But I bet she'd have got a kick out of you. I imagine you're quite the little steamroller, too, aren't you? That I have to doubt. She used to say that word for word. How could it be a good thing if I looked so much like this woman whose kids didn't even seem to love her very much? Mostly from what they didn't say, I got the idea she must have been mean or something. Did I come off like I was mean? I told Uncle Carl I was fairly wishy-washy, which was completely true. It was even a problem I had. So we were walking, and it seems like we've walked a long ways, and I'm about to ask him why he thought he had to park on the outskirts of town when we finally get to his truck. He's left it running this whole time, and we're back in that diesel smell. He's the kind of guy who buys tractors two at a time, and he's got two great big blue tractors chained onto the back of his truck, which does not look safe to me. He says as long as he was over this way, he thought he might as well get me, too. Hop in, he says. You're way above the road in that thing, up in the cab of his truck, and it is fun for a while, for a little ways, but then there gets to be a lot more of this state than there really needs to be, and you just keep going. You get off the bus, and then you get on that truck, and you drive, and you drive, and you drive, and you've already been over the mountains, but it's hundreds of miles left to go. And you're riding with Uncle Carl, who tells you jokes he got from Reader's Digest, and you try to laugh, but after a while it's really hard. And he's talking about his farm, his family, and it's cute how much he likes them. But we're driving and driving, and the farther we go, the less there is to look at. And you're on and on until you're out there where the only thing there is in any direction is wheat fields and silos, and you can see for 100 miles. Finally, I had to tell Uncle Carl that I needed to use the facilities, and I'm just praying he doesn't have something in his truck that you're supposed to pee in, but it works out fine because we stop at this place that pops up along the road. It's a truck stop in the middle of nowhere, and all I want is to use the restroom and maybe have a cheeseburger. But Uncle Carl says, no way. He says this place serves the best ribeye on the High Line, and I might kick myself for the rest of my life if I passed on that. So I had one, and it was bloody and hot, and with the onion rings and the potato and the peas and toast and tea and everything, it was too much. And that big piece of pie I had. So now we're back in the truck again, and we keep on going. And if you ask me, if you ask my sad tummy, it's all too much. But we do keep going. The sun will just not go down, but we finally get there. And on the way down their lane, Uncle Carl shows me where there's a graveyard behind the orchard. Your people, he says. He tells me it's the family farm, and I'm not exactly sure what he means by that, but this sort of explains my mom, I think, if this is where she grew up. I guess they bury their own dead people, just dig their own hole and throw them in, which is a little too basic for me.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Matt Pavlich about his collection of stories titled Survivors Said. If you'd like to listen again or share this program with a friend, it's available as a podcast and at our blog. Links to both are at mtpr.org/twq. By the way, we are on Facebook and Twitter, and if you follow us there, you might win a free book sometime. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about more of the stories in the collection and about Matt's writing process. Don't go away. In the story, Deneen or Not Deneen, you've created a character who wants to die, but the court system won't let her. Is Deneen based on somebody you know?
Two somebodies. Actually, that story is maybe the most autobiographical I've ever met, and I'm not Deneen, by the way, but was the public defender. I actually argued that issue on both sides of the issue.
We'll just pause here to say that you are an attorney.
And in each instance, the woman did in fact want to end her life. And the question was whether or not the state, or in one instance, the tribe, should intervene. And in both instances, the tribe didn't intervene, or the state, as the case happened to be.
And so in each case, the woman was sent to Warm Springs for her own protection?
Right.
Out on a Fire takes place when a crew is sent out to fight a fire. I think it was in the panhandle of Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And Clift, one of the firefighters, wonders, why did everything conspire against his significance? And I liked that concept. Tell us what he's struggling with.
Oh, I think he's struggling with a young man's burgeoning or not burgeoning sense of self. That is also kind of an autobiographical, certainly in the sense that at that time of life, that was what I was dealing with, you know. Why am I so insignificant? I'm not sure I've emerged from that question yet, but it seemed to me at that time that trying to separate myself from my circumstances was something I was not doing a real good job of.
Well, he was even looking at trees and machinery and feeling insignificant compared to them.
Certainly. I mean, if you've ever worked with a shovel in the presence of a bulldozer, I don't know how you can feel any other way.
Well,
unless you're John Henry or something.
That makes the point quite well, yes. Which of these stories can you identify as one that was just really a challenge to wrestle into its final form?
All of them. Everything I write is, you know, nothing comes particularly easy to me. I think maybe the easiest of the stories to write, the one that I blazed through the first draft most quickly, was the final one. And sometimes when I get in voice, and it's especially if the voice is pretty distinct from my own, the voice will kind of lead me through the story a little more easily. But for me, there are no easy stories.
So you're wrestling every time you write?
Pretty much.
Do you enjoy that challenge?
It's a sort of, I'm sure it's a love-hate thing, but love must predominate because it's, you know, I've done it for an awful long time now.
And you still keep doing it. Are you still working as an attorney full-time and
no,
writing?
No, I just about 6 months ago quit working as an attorney, and probably altogether so that I can write. I just think I've got a lot more writing to do and maybe not too much more time to do it, so that I'd better bend my efforts that way.
So writing for you is kind of like this thing that makes you do it.
Yes.
Your last book was a novel. This one's a collection of stories. I think, have you written two collections of stories and two novels?
Two novels and two collections of stories. It's a little disingenuous to say I've written two collections because the first collection is largely contained in this collection. I think there were seven stories in that collection. And of those, five appear here. Of course, several of those have been pretty substantially reworked since then.
And there are 19 stories in this collection. Right. Yeah. Which do you prefer, the novel? Or, I mean, you say some of these stories, you wanted to write a novel out of them. Is that what your inclination is, to write a novel?
I've been directed to write a novel. Stories at this juncture in history are pretty hard sell, I guess. I really like stories. Someone was asked about writing, if they liked writing, and they responded that they liked having written. Right? That makes sense to me. And of course, you get to that point a lot sooner with a short story than with a novel. The novel affords you more room. But I like the concision and impact of a short story. I mean, as I think of literary works that have been really impactful on me, a lot of them are short stories.
So when you go to a party and somebody asks you what you do, what do you say to them these days?
I haven't gone to parties for a long time. I work in the criminal law. I doesn't field that question, you know. Plus, I've lived in communities where the people I've either put in or kept out of jail are likely to be at the party, and I just don't want to have that discussion anymore.
But okay, if I say to you, what do you do, and you tell me you're a writer, I mean, what kind of a response do you get from people when you tell them you're a writer?
Kind of a difficult one. What do you write about? An honest answer to that question for me would everything, all the important stuff. But that's not an answer that would satisfy anybody asking the question. But it's about as accurate as I can be in terms of what I write about.
It seems like it would be a really challenging question to get for any writer, except a writer who can say, I write mystery novels.
Yeah, it's as a genre writer, at least you can kind of feel that question. And of course, mystery writers, among other mystery writers, wouldn't find that very satisfying either, because each of them want to stake out their own little territory and would like to be able to explain that. But the people who generally ask that question aren't really interested in that detailed an answer. So you can just sort of conclude the conversation by saying that.
Being a writer in my own way, the hardest thing for me is to actually sit down and get going with the first paragraph. Is that the same for you?
It's certainly the same with me. The first probably dozen stories I wrote the first paragraph or first page so much that typically I would commit them to memory. That is the hardest part, because in starting, the blank page is maybe the most frightening thing in the world. I mean, there's nothing there but limitless possibility, which seems like it would offer a lot of license. But I like to start by limiting the possibilities, and then there are fewer choices to make as you go through. I'm pretty sure your experience is pretty similar to everyone's in that respect. And I guess people who are just starting to write should know that first part, as tough as it is, that is the toughest part. And if you get past that, it becomes a little bit easier, at least. The first page or first paragraph of a story, or any story of any length, puts me in it. And I'll work for weeks and weeks and weeks to get that right so that I can get the rest of it right, so that I can be in the time and the place and the people that I need to be in and looking at it. And it takes a while to make that leap.
Don't you think that's why a lot of people fail as writers or stop doing it? Because it's so hard to get the first part going.
I'm sure it is. And also, well, with fiction, I can think of any number of people I know who are really fine prose writers. Can't write fiction, and it's just a question of imagination, frankly. You have to have that capacity to relocate yourself inside the story, and not everyone has that capacity.
What do you want people to know about this book, about this collection of stories?
I would like them to know that my object, at least, is to provide stories that wear well, that you'll like upon first reading and like better if you should happen to read them again, and like still better if several years later you pick up the book and read it a third time. I try to write stories that are durable in that way.
Well, there are a lot of very memorable characters in this book, people that stayed with me after I'd finished those stories. So I think you have succeeded in making something that's durable anyway.
Good.
Matt Pavelich lives in Hot Springs, Montana. Look for more information about him at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also on the blog, poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Follow us on social media if you'd like a chance to win some free stuff. Thank you for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.